Back in April, I posted a long essay called Too Long in Lincoln's Shadow on ZNet. So if any of you are interested in reading it, you can. It's a very long piece. This talk will be based on that essay. I'll try to encapsulate and cut down some of the material because it would be too long to go into all of it here. After posting it on a couple of websites, including Mitchell Cohn's, we reposted it on his, I got a few comments, and a couple of those comments will figure in this presentation. One comment that a reader of Mitchell's website or blog posted was, after making some remarks critical about the essay and otherwise, she writes at the end, "It has always been mystifying that Americans identify with the rich who oppress them and not the underdogs. Certainly this movie," and she's talking about the Spielberg's recent movie Lincoln, "does nothing to address this curious bent of the American psyche." I thought that was a very perceptive comment, and very much what I'm going to try to do using my essay as the material is to address that question, this curious bent of the American psyche. And what I'm going to try to do, it's a question that deserves book-length treatment and has received that, is I'm going to try to explore how Lincoln figures in that, and that's really the purpose of my talk. Okay, so let's start with the recent film. Have any of you seen the Spielberg film?
Yeah,
okay, so this is not totally unknown to you, and you certainly heard about it. Okay, so I'll just go into. I'm going to use the film to explore one dichotomy about Lincoln, and that is the dichotomy between pragmatism and idealism. I'm going to look at a couple of dichotomies to help us get at this overall question that I'm trying to look at. All right, the plot of the movie that Spielberg and his scriptwriter Tony Kushner presents. It's a curious plot because it's. The Civil War has immense, dramatic possibilities. Gone with the Wind, of course, and many other films have used it as a basis. Spielberg's film focuses on a legislative battle, Lincoln's efforts to get a constitutional amendment through Congress to abolish slavery in January of 1865. And this casts Lincoln primarily as a political strategist and manager. We see him maneuvering among the various factions, both inside his party and in Congress, making deals, compromising, cajoling, gathering support however he can, including with the lure of patronage. This is not the high school history figure of Father Abraham intoning the Gettysburg Address, though that speech does make an appearance. This is meant to be a more realistic Lincoln, the portrait of a pragmatic politician, Lincoln as a horse trader. Not that Spielberg and Kushner intend this in any negative sense. On the contrary, their idea is that horse trading is itself a kind of heroism. And that's where the tie into the present goes. That's where they link up the question of Lincoln as a historical figure with what's going on today in contemporary politics. And here, Tony Kushner has been quite articulate in a number of interviews he's given, both to Bill Moyers and on NPR. He writes that he said he found it useful in, I'm sure many of you have heard of Tony Kushner, Angels in America. He's among the most famous playwrights and scriptwriters in the country. Anyway, he said he found it valuable in working on the script to look at the Obama years through a Lincoln lens. And he explains that, "I think Obama is a great president," okay, this is Kushner speaking, not me, "and I feel that there is immense potential now for rebuilding a progressive democracy in this country after a great deal of damage has been done to it, presumably in the Bush years." Kushner goes on to say that one of the obstacles in Obama's way, however, ironically in a sense, is, quote, "an impatience on the part of very good, very progressive people with the kind of compromising, the kind of horse trading that is necessary. Again, this is Kushner. Great politicians like Lincoln, and presumably Kushner would include Obama as well, are good at deal making. And then Kushner explains what he means by that, because that's in fact what politics is. It's not about purity, it's about compromise and strategy and making things actually happen in real time on this earth as opposed to a metaphysical realm. In the movie that Kushner wrote, Lincoln exemplifies this getting things done pragmatism, while by way of contrast, there's the radical Republican Congressman Thaddeus Stevens, who is a good person who has to learn to forego his metaphysical purity to achieve a great purpose, in this case, the 13th Amendment abolishing slavery. So that's Kushner's motivation behind the film, and I think, you know, we can call the Spielberg film Lincoln for Obama Times. This is obviously very different than other images of Lincoln that we've had in the past, including from Hollywood. But it's, you know, at least for me, a puzzling explanation of why this approach to Lincoln. You would think from what Kushner says that the Obama years have been crowded with a lot of latter-day Thaddeus Stevenses, in other words, progressive purists besieging the great man in the White House. If there are such people inside the administration or even in Congress, they have done an awfully good job of hiding themselves for the last 5 years. It's true that outside the corridors of power, there have been widespread disillusionment with Obama, and no doubt this is what Spielberg and Kushner had in mind. Many progressives thought they were voting for a new FDR in 2008, you know, with whatever limitations Roosevelt had. Instead, they got, you know, basically a new version of Bill Clinton, and often without even Clinton's canniness. Obama's idea of horse trading often seems to be to give away the horse in exchange for a knuckle sandwich. So, as for rebuilding progressive democracy, wow, you know, when Kushner gave this interview, we hadn't heard about all the secret, you know, taping of phone calls. But we, of course, already knew about, you know, meetings every Tuesday in the White House to make kill lists in places like Afghanistan and other places around the world. You know, the continuing operation of Guantanamo. So this is not exactly, you know, and to say nothing of the biggest social problem, which is the growing gap between the haves and the have-nots in this country. So to conceive of this period as a kind of new, you know, Lincolnian new birth of freedom is more than a bit of a stretch. Many progressives no doubt voted for Obama a second time only because the other guy would have been worse. But this can hardly be taken as a sign of a thriving democracy. Meanwhile, the country itself is more deeply divided politically than it's been since the Civil War, and the forces of reaction are becoming more extreme and vitriolic. You would think that at such a moment we have more need of Lincoln the visionary than Lincoln the horse trader, but that's just why a conservative like New York Times columnist David Brooks likes the Spielberg film, because it shifts attention away from what he calls the Gettysburg phase of Lincoln's career, in other words, where Lincoln was at his most revolutionary. In that phase, according to Brooks, a leader expresses grand ideas. This, frankly, is relatively easy. Lots of people embrace grand ideals or all-explaining ideologies, but satisfied with that, they become morally infantile. They refuse to compromise, insult their opponents, and isolate themselves on the perch of their own solipsism. Wow, that's quite a description of idealism. You know, expressing grand ideas is relatively easy. You know, who knew? You know, I mean, most of us would be very happy, you know, who are involved in politics, to have the opportunity of expressing some grand ideas. People like you know, Harriet Beecher Stowe, Frederick Douglass, Tom Paine, Thomas Jefferson, Martin Luther King. This is not exactly a list of the morally infantile. Brooks is writing off the role of idealism in politics. And to be honest, you know, the film and Kushner's script gives him license to do that, which is really, you know, something, you know, a very, deeply disturbing aspect of that film. Needless to say, or it needs, in light of that, it absolutely needs to be said that there would never have been a 13th Amendment. There would never have been the end of slavery in this country had it not been for the idealism of the abolitionists, who were metaphysical purists of the first order, who created a climate of opinion in which slavery came to be seen for the moral abomination that it was. And without that climate of opinion, Lincoln would have never been elected, the Civil War wouldn't have been fought, or it would have been lost, and the horse traders in Congress would have been haggling over how much slavery, not how to abolish it. So, idealism isn't some solipsistic exercise in feeling morally superior, as David Brooks would have us believe. Rather, it's an indispensable factor in shaping the direction of politics, especially at critical junctures of history. Historian Richard Hofstadter, who's, I think, one of the great 20th century American historians, called the idealist, he was speaking of the abolitionist Wendell Phillips, a crisis thinker, and I love that expression. I think that really gets to the heart of what it means to be that kind of person, a radical at their best, because such a thinker thinks in terms of the ultimate potentialities of social conflicts rather than the immediate compromises by which they are softened. His moral judgments are made from the standpoint of absolute values with which the mass of men cannot comfortably live. Relegated to the margins in normal times, the idealist turns from a pariah to a prophet in a social crisis when thinking in terms of ultimate potentialities suddenly seems to correspond to the way things really are and offers the only road out of the impasse brought about by the horse traders of mainstream politics. The fact is, though, that in our time, progressives have less of a sense of ultimate potential, have almost no sense of ultimate potentialities today. There's broad agreement about what we are against, but almost none about what we are for. I mean, a perfect example of that is the idea that, the movement is now defined as an anti-capitalist movement. In other words, it's defined by what it's against. It's not defined by what it's for. Socialism or whatever, but in previous generations there was a very clear understanding of where we were heading. Today there isn't. This gives the enemies of progress an immense advantage. There's a famous line by Yeats, which I quote: "The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity," and that really fits the current political conjuncture very, very well. Pragmatism, we have had a lot of. The Clinton years were one huge long exercise in horse trading, lesser evilism, triangulation, all the stock and trade of this kind of politics. And the upshot of it all was a steady shift to the right. Anyone remember the famous Clintonian end of welfare in our time? It was Clinton who brought us bank deregulation that eventually led to the subprime mortgage crisis. So, and of course, Clinton paved the way for the most reactionary regime in history, the Bush administration, or recent history, I should say. Obama is treading the same path, and it isn't hard to see a similar outcome a few years down the road. I think the crying need now is not for more pragmatism, but for more idealism, the very thing the new Lincoln film discounts. Okay, so that's the first dichotomy I wanted to look at in relationship to Lincoln, and that's really in relationship to an image of Lincoln, the image presented by Spielberg and Kushner. I now want to look at a second democracy, second dichotomy, which is in relationship to democracy. Lincoln is, of course, one of the great iconic figures of democracy. And I wanted to examine Lincoln in light of that. And what I want to do is I want to compare a couple of big historical events, that's with the capital B, big historical, capital H, events, capital E, operate in our collective consciousness. So here I'm comparing the French Revolution and the American Civil War. The Revolution happens about 70 years before the American Civil War. When you think about the Revolution, probably the first thing that comes to your mind is the storming of the Bastille. right? Now that is the iconic image of that revolution. When you think of the Civil War, the iconic image is usually something to do with Lincoln. He dominates his slice of history to an unprecedented degree, far more than, say, Washington does the American Revolution. Even in the pantheon of American heroes, he stands out. No other president comes close to the kind of adulation Lincoln receives. And you see this expressed in the various presidential memorials in Washington, D.C. Washington's and Jefferson's are monuments of respect, but the Lincoln Memorial elicits a catch-in-your-throat reverence. It's the highest shrine of the secular religion of Americanism. In other words, Lincoln's legacy is a powerful narrative about a great man making history. Spielberg's Lincoln adds yet more luster to Lincoln's halo. Indeed, so tight is the film's focus on the great man that virtually everyone else recedes into the background. It's been noted by a few people, including a history prof in the op-ed pages of the Times, that the African-American characters in the film do almost nothing but passively wait for white men to liberate them. The millions of soldiers, white and black, who did the fighting and dying that made the abolition of slavery possible don't get much better treatment. There's a very short scene at the beginning, and that's pretty much it. Though there have been other attempts to present a far more balanced approach, and probably the best known is the Ken Burns PBS series on the Civil War, Lincoln is still the overwhelming image that looms over this history. And, you know, the other alternative, of course, is Howard Zinn's, which is basically to shove Lincoln off the stage entirely, to basically say that Lincoln was just somebody who operated for the elites, the financial, the industrial elite of America, etc. Ultimately, I don't find Zinn's reading of that of this history terribly convincing. The truth is that the people, that Lincoln, of course, always evokes, played a supporting role in the great drama of the Civil War. And that's true not just in the history books or the movies, but in reality. The Lincoln legend is an exaggeration, but it is not a fabrication. It's true that there was considerably more involvement of ordinary people, black and white, in the struggle against the Confederacy than a movie like Spielberg's Lincoln portrays. But to make out that the Civil War is a grassroots struggle for freedom is not true. The only time the grassroots intervened independently was John Brown's abortive uprising in 1859. And though his martyrdom arguably galvanized anti-war sentiment in the North, there's actually a big debate about whether it did or didn't, that sentiment wasn't channeled into mass action, but into the election of Lincoln. From then on, the history of the Civil War is far more about top-down military action than grassroots mobilization. Not that the grassroots vanish, they make their presence felt in some extraordinary ways, as with the 200,000 African Americans, mostly ex-slaves, who enlist voluntarily in the Union Army after the Emancipation Proclamation, providing manpower that was essential to winning the war at the time when recruitment among whites was in serious decline. But even this inspiring example conforms to the basic pattern that the only way the people could impact events was through their support for the government and the Union Army. Just let me quickly say that there's a certain irony to this that even Lincoln himself would have appreciated in his most famous speech, the Gettysburg Address. He makes mention among, of course, the famous iconic phrases, a new birth of freedom, government of the people, by the people, for the people. He also says, the world will little note nor long remember what we say here, but it cannot forget what they did here, the they being the soldiers who died at Gettysburg, thousands of them. One of the most, you know, important but also horrific, tens of thousands, one of the most horrific battles of the war. This is the sort of thing you would expect a political leader to say when dedicating a battlefield cemetery, because the address, of course, was done a few months after the battle. But there's no reason to doubt Lincoln's sincerity. He obviously had no way of knowing how famous his speech would become. But as it's turned out, the irony is that the speech is better remembered than the battle. I mean, most of us learn the speech in high school. You know, I'm from Canada, and I even know the speech, you know. I mean, so it's become iconic. There are very few people, unless you're a history buff, who know a great deal about the Battle of Gettysburg, about things like Little Round Top, which is an incident of incredible heroism by the Union Army and Pickett's charge, incredible foolish heroism by the Confederate soldiers. These are, you know, tremendously important in terms of the history of that battle and militarily in the Civil War, but they don't register on mass consciousness hardly at all. So it might seem unfair that mere words should count for more than the sacrifice of thousands of lives, but the speech deserves its fame. It articulates with eloquence and simplicity.
How much more do you got?
10 more minutes, is that doable? Five?
Five.
Okay, five. It articulates with eloquent simplicity the great political purpose for all that sacrifice, but this in turn only underscores how much it was Lincoln who shaped and defined, who made this history. To be sure, he made it in the name of the people, in the name of democracy, but he made it. And so it's his name that has come to dominate it. Okay, because I'm running out of time, I'll just be as quick as I can. It can be argued that history is always like this. The greats make it, the rest of us endure it. But this is a glibly conservative view. Progressive change in our time depends on empowering masses of people, but an uncritical admiration for Lincoln feeds the dangerous illusion that we don't need that empowerment, that all we need is another great leader in the White House, or a more seductive variation of the same idea that the great leader will do the empowering. But freedom can't be bestowed as a gift. It has to be won in struggle, wrenched out of oppression. Lincoln abolished slavery, but this only meant a marginal change in the lives of the vast majority of African Americans. They went from the chains of bondage to the cage of Jim Crow segregation, which lasted for a century until the rise of the Civil Rights Movement. Okay, I'm going to skip over a large part. As I say, this is online, and you can read it at your leisure. I just want to go to to look at the problematic of Lincoln in terms of the left quickly. I mentioned it in there. A couple of years ago, I ran into a graphic novel. I came across a graphic novel of Lincoln delivering the Gettysburg Address to an anti-globalization rally. I'm sure there's a version of Lincoln doing this now at an occupation. Much of the legend of Lincoln comes from talented left-wingers like Carl Sandburg, the writer, the composer Aaron Copland. This is the, there is a long history here, particularly of the Communist Party in the 1930s and the Popular Frontism, where the Communist Party defined communism as as Americanism in the 20th century, and the figure of Lincoln featured prominently in their election campaigning material. What I say here is this, that and obviously Lincoln played a huge role in the civil rights movement in the 60s. Of course, it makes sense for the civil rights movement to evoke Lincoln's abolition of slavery. The left equally has a claim on that history in its fight against social inequality. But there are limits to how far that claim can be pushed. Renting Lincoln's halo for a favored cause always runs the risk of buying into illusions about White House saviors. The symbolism of Lincoln works two ways. It's about freedom, but it's also about working through the system to achieve it. The civil rights movement bought into the whole symbolical package and ended up, I think not coincidentally, with a halfway victory at best. Obviously there are progressives who still buy into it. Kushner is a good example of that. The other problem that, and I'll just summarize very quickly, the other problem with Lincoln in terms of, his symbolism is the nature of democracy itself. Lincoln has made democracy an incredibly attractive thing in America. There's a prominent Civil War historian who I want to quote here quickly. He says, I wonder out loud whether one reason there is no socialism in America is because of Lincoln. It's a strange thing that he's himself a biographer of Lincoln and an admirer of him. He says, in the American context, Lincoln imparted to liberal democracy a sense of nobility and purpose that he has not always had in other contexts. He makes democracy something transcendent, and especially at Gettysburg, where he talks about the nation having this new birth of freedom, he ratchets the horizons of liberal democracy right up past the spires of the Cologne Cathedral, which is one of the great Gothic cathedrals of Europe, and he makes it this glowing, attractive ideal that people are willing to make these tremendous sacrifices to protect. I think that that's true, and I think that's a problem for the left, because the left is really not just about political democracy. The left is not just about government of the people, by the people, for the people. The left is about what divides society. It's about the gap and the chasm between the haves and the have-nots. And that's a kind of democracy that Lincoln cannot inspire us to. It's economic democracy, which is a concept that didn't even enter into Lincoln's lexicon or into his consciousness. So I think that's where the problem of Lincoln and the left for me is centered on. Thanks a lot, and thanks for your patience.
Thank you.